Thanks for tuning in. I'm Logan Quigley, one of the series producers for the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. Welcome to another Speculum Spotlight episode. These special episodes are collaborations between our podcast and Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. Each episode is designed to bring you behind the scenes of an article published in the current issue of Speculum. In this case, Volume 100, Issue 4. In today's episode, we're spotlighting the article East-West Connections in the 14th Century, John of Marignolli and the Tribute Horse, by Nancy Wu. Wu's article examines primary texts and paintings that are crucial to our understanding of a seemingly uncomplicated visit in 1342 by the Franciscan, John of Marignolli, to the court of the Mongol Khan, Togon Temur, in China. Aimed at deciphering the cultural and historical implications of this encounter, both synchronically and diachronically, Wu's article explores how the gift of a horse from the friar to the Mongol Khan came about, how it was received in 14th century China, and how the gift intersected with more than 1,500 years of the Chinese notion of the heavenly horse and the tributary system, as it was reflected in canonic Chinese literature and paintings. Today's episode host is Lauren Cantrell, a PhD candidate in the Department of French at the University of Virginia, and also a producer for the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. Our author, Nancy Wu, is Educator Emerita at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Thanks again for listening, and now let me turn the conversation over to Lauren and Nancy.
Hi, my name is Lauren Cantrell, and I'm one of the producers here of the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. And I'm joined today by Nancy Wu, who is Educator Emerita at the Met. And we're here to talk about her latest contribution to Speculum. So welcome, Nancy. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure and it's an honor.
I was wondering if we could start by you just in your own words, maybe giving us a sort of overview of what this piece is all about, what brought you to the piece, just in your own words.
I see this piece as an intersection, and it's a word that I don't really like because it's been used too much, but it is truly an intersection, like a crossroad between two things. Geographically, it's a story stretching from medieval Europe, from Italy, all the way to China in the 14th century. Temporally, it stretches from the Han Dynasty in China, which is, you know, 2nd century BCE to 2nd century CE, roughly, all the way to the 14th century. And what creates this intersection is the visit of a Franciscan missionary, John of Marignolli, who presented a horse to the ruler of China, who was Mongol at the time. And from there, I was able to sort of dissect the history of the Franciscans in China a little bit, but also the significance of the horse as it stood in European culture and Chinese culture. And I use the word China or Chinese very cautiously because 14th century China was a very multicultural entity. So this is sort of the gist of an intersection, a crossroad of cultures and of histories.
What's amazing about the article for me too, I mean, and like you were just saying, it truly spans geographies just because we have a European traveling all the way from, I believe he starts in Genoa. Am I right about that? He starts in Genoa and then travels across the Golden Horde, across the Khanate, all the way to the Yang Dynasty to present this horse. So we have this figure who goes on this great journey over several years. Is that right?
Yes, correct. He started from Naples, actually. But I mean, one can argue he might have started from somewhere else. But anyway, so he boarded a vessel at Naples, put it this way. And from there, and this was a very typical sea route, he went around the Mediterranean shores to cross the Black Sea to Crimea. And once reaching Crimea, the group started their land journey eastward, crossing two separate Mongol Khanates in order to reach China, which at the time belonged to this great Mongol empire that ruled China since the middle of the 13th century. So it was an arduous, long journey. And he would stop at places, sometimes extensively. He stopped at Al-Malik, which is today in the far, far, far west corner of China. But at the time, it was part of the Golden Horde Khanate. And he stayed there because the area's Franciscans had just experienced a major bloodbath. A lot of the Franciscans died. So he stayed there to sort of reestablish the Franciscan church, making sure there was a running church where sacraments can be performed, where parishioners had a place to go. Then he went on to China. So one of the things that I take away, I suppose, from doing this work is to stop myself from complaining about flying back to Asia, which I do maybe once a year, because what is the big deal if you're sitting on the plane for 15 hours when it would take months, if not years, for these people to go through this process just to reach China?
Absolutely. And years of, I suppose, networking and connections and making exchanges along the way. And in this piece, you're describing the journey of this man and the encounter he has with the Khan ruler. But I was curious to know about a bit of the history of the Franciscans here in this context. So you describe in the article how the missionary work of the Franciscans essentially ended with the overtaking of the Yan by the Ming Dynasty in 1368. I think you write, despite lasting approximately 75 years, the mission left little discernible mark on China's populace. And I was just wondering why you think the Franciscan presence seemed to be so evidently unsuccessful in their sort of mission work here in the East.
The answer may be longer than you expected. I think it's necessary to point out that the Franciscans and the Dominicans as well, the mendicants, were the majority of the missionaries sent by European monarchs, Louis IX being one of them, and successive popes to Mongol-controlled areas, not just China, in order to convince the Mongols to convert to the Latin Church, which is less important. More important was to form a military alliance with the Mongols so that the Mongols on the east and the Latins, Europeans on the west, can deal with particularly the Mamluks, the Islamic forces that were very active in the Middle East at the time. So it was not just a religious expedition, it was diplomatic, it was political. So the Franciscans first arrived in today's Beijing, then Kambalik, which was the capital of the Mongol dynasty, which is the Yuan dynasty in Chinese, in the 1290s. And from the Franciscan sources, we have probably under 10 names of the Franciscans who were specifically sent to China as missionaries. So even if there were probably more people than the dozen or so names that we have on record, it was never a very large group of people doing the work. That's number one. And number two, once they became active in the 14th century, remember concurrently in Europe, they started the Black Death, the plague. So reinforcement from Europe began to die down. So the Franciscans who had gone to China were getting old, and they said so themselves. They were looking forward to more new blood coming from Europe, which was not happening. And the reason I say that they didn't leave any mark was because there's no Chinese record, at least nobody has found any. There's no record in the Chinese language from that time period that mentioned the presence of the Franciscans. Now, it is possible that something is out there that waiting for us to discover, but there's nothing. And once 1368 happened, meaning when the next dynasty, the ethnically Han Chinese dynasty, the Ming dynasty, overtook China from the Mongols, the dynasty went through initially a period that was very xenophobic. most of the foreigners, not just the Franciscans, but most of the foreigners were expelled from China, wiping out whatever record, whatever remains, buildings, churches, objects that the Franciscans might have left. Some scholars over the years in the 20th century have mentioned or identified some mentions in historical documents much later, in Chinese documents, of the Franciscan medieval objects that had survived, according to those Franciscans who arrived in China later in the 17th, 18th centuries. But even those objects mentioned in the later material had disappeared. So we have nothing about the Franciscans except for a tombstone of a Franciscan bishop in the south of China, which is a subject that I'm working on right now.
I would like to know more about what the logistical work was like managing so many sources, both documents, and you're working with art history here as well, working across these different languages and traditions. You even, at some points in the piece, you dive into some equine husbandry history, which was really thorough and impressive. I couldn't believe the level of detail we're getting on equine practices. I found that fascinating. So what was it like wrangling all this material? And perhaps even if you were to advise, you know, other scholars or even up-and-coming scholars how to tackle such a broad and reaching subject, what have you done to handle this material, and what would you recommend others do?
Well, put it this way, I started very modestly. I had no idea what I was getting into. I was interested in general, the history of the Franciscans in 14 China, that's it. And then I stumble into this Zhang of Marinelli guy who presented this horse to the Chinese emperor, who was a Mongol. And this was the only thing that the Chinese or the Mongols had mentioned. Never about John as a Franciscan or as a papal envoy, but about the horse. So that brought me to the Chinese obsession of not just any horse, but the so-called heavenly horse. So I started tracing that history all the way back to the Han Dynasty. And then at one point, I went back to the original texts describing the entourage sent by the Mongol emperor, the very same guy, to the Pope in Avignon, in which he listed some objects, some gift that he expected from the Pope. And there he said, a horse or horses from the setting sun. That never got picked up by terribly many people. And I said to myself, wait a second, the setting sun, the sun sets in the west. He's talking about the west. That is the heavenly horse, right? And so things just started to gel. And I have to emphasize, I'm not the first one to make this connection, not by any means, but I think I'm the first one to connect it to horse husbandry, horse administration, particularly important during the Yuan Dynasty, because the Mongols, as everybody knows, were and continue to be horse people. Horses are so important to their history, to their culture, to their society, to their economy. And so luckily, there have been some Chinese scholars who worked on horse administrations. And then there I discovered and referenced, again, from the Yuan Dynasty, from the 14th century, complaining about the dwindling number of horses, that the husbandry policy was failing. And so, again, putting the two and two together, all primary documents, by the way, I came up with this theory. So to answer the other part of your question, starting out modestly and then beginning to branch out, it's a very natural process all of us doing history would experience. That is not surprising. What is challenging, of course, is that it is not just art history. It is not just history. It's not just Italy. It's not just the Franciscans. It's not just the Chinese. It's not just the Mongols in Chinese. It's not just the Mongols. It's not just the mission. It's not just the horses. So how do you divide up the material into separate buckets, so to speak? That is very difficult, but because very often you cannot. Very often one article or one book can go to different buckets if you were trying to organize things. So I don't know if the listeners are aware of a software called Rotero, something like that.
Oh, Zotero?
Zotero, right. It's a bibliographic software. So I tried to use that, then I gave up because it is just too complicated. So what I did was I file digitally everything that I read alphabetically by author. And then I create subfolders attempting to group together those sources that clearly belong to individual buckets. The rest, I rely on my own memory, which is getting worse and worse. But so it's a lot of, it requires a great deal of organization. And I don't dare to say I did a perfect job, far from it, but it is a matter of organization. As to languages, you know, for 30 or 40 years prior to going into this project, my focus was French Gothic architecture. So I read French, and from French, I can sort of finagle Italian. I was born in Taiwan, so Chinese is my first language, although I hadn't used the language for research ever until I started this project. Classical Chinese is a totally different game. It's a little bit like Latin in that you need to know the language to put in the punctuation in order to make sentences out of the text. And so that took me a while to get into that motion. I am not completely confident with some of the languages. So I was very lucky to have some colleagues who are willing to double check my translations. And this is why in the article, I thanked particularly the late Elizabeth A.R. Brown, who we know as Peggy Brown, who reads Latin, or who read Latin forward and backward. And she would go through my Latin translations, and she would even criticize sometimes the mistakes in the Latin written by my 14th century Franciscan people. So it's also a collaboration. It's a group project. So I would strongly urge the younger listeners to this podcast to make friends, to get to know people, colleagues in the field, and expand that field. These colleagues and friends will come very, very handy when you ever need to do a project like this.
A significant portion of this piece that you've written hinges on this painting of the tribute of this horse given by John Marignolli to the Khan. And I was wondering if you could tell us more about how you came to access this painting. You know, what did that look like, tracking that down? How has it come to us in the present day? How is it that we have that available?
You know, for the longest time, nobody knew about this painting or the connection of the painting, I should say, to John of Marignolli. The painting was spotted by a French Jesuit missionary in Beijing in the 18th century. He saw the painting and he said this came from Europe, but he didn't know anything about the background of this painting. The great French sinologist Paul Pelliot knew not only about this earlier French missionary's sighting of the painting, Pelliot also knew of Chinese sources that I cited and quoted in my article from the 14th century describing the presentation of this horse to the Mongol emperor. So I have these two French people to thank for giving us early information about this painting. But Pelliot, who wrote early in the 20th century, said that the painting had disappeared from written records. So it might have been blown up during the Boxer Rebellion when Western forces sacked Beijing pretty badly. So most people writing about the Franciscan mission in China in the early part of the 20th century, I would say the most part of the 20th century, didn't know about the existence of this painting. Lauren Arnold might have been the first one publishing in the late 1990s about this painting.
And you suggest in the article that this encounter, it hinges on this gift of the horse, and it's interpreted very differently from the Western givers of the horse, from the Eastern receivers of this horse. And so I wonder if you could talk to us about that sort of discrepancy, about what the meaning of this gift is and how that shapes this encounter and how it shapes the perception of this encounter later.
Sure. So I think from the European sources, the horse was a gift in response to the request of the Mongol emperor, as I mentioned earlier, who wanted horses from the setting sun. And it took John of Marignolli 4 years to finally make it to China to present the horse to the emperor. Now, John of Marignolli said he presented horses, plural. The Chinese were very excited about the horse. There were up to a dozen poems or prose or, you know, and then there was the encomium commissioned by the emperor himself to say, write something to describe the encounter. So from the Chinese sources, we got to know some information that John Marignolli did not provide, namely the date, the exact date is amazing, the date and the location of the encounter, which happened in the Summer Palace in Inner Mongolia. And the Chinese sources also described that there was some kind of a language barrier, that they couldn't understand each other by words, but somehow they were able to communicate at the meeting, which is very different from Zheng of Marignolli's description, who said he presented the horse, the emperor loved it, and then there was a procession ending up at the palace of the emperor. He prayed, there was the processional cross, there were the candles, there was the final prayer and the blessing and so on and so forth. So the two descriptions could not have been more different in that John described a communal event partaken by both sides, whereas the Chinese description focused on nothing but the horse. They gave even the dimensions of the horse and one horse. Several sources said one horse versus Zhang's description, horses. Now, the horse was just as important for Zhang as it was for the Mongols and the Chinese, because when he listed the gifts he presented to the emperor, he listed the horse, or horses, I should say, horses, before he mentioned letters and gifts from the popes and from European princes. So the horse was absolutely important for both sides, but was perceived completely differently by each. The Europeans saw this as a presentation of a gift. I'm giving you a gift. For the Chinese, you're presenting me a tribute to show that you are subservient to me. I am the center or the higher power, whatever you call it, more powerful. And I am receiving this gift, a tribute presented to me. So the two sides never really came together in terms of understanding exactly the purpose and the meaning of this presentation.
And what is it we learn from investigating these discrepancies? You know, we have these different interpretations of this same encounter. You have such detailed information about the encounter. I believe you said it took place on the 19th of August that year as well, too. So we're pretty close to the date. But what is the importance of getting details like this right? I suppose right is almost an inverted commas there. And then what do we learn about investigating these discrepancies between the two sides? What does it tell us about either end of this encounter?
You are absolutely correct. I can never say I got it right because I don't know, right? But what I relied on was to have multiple sources describing one event. from the European side, I only had John of Marignolli. I had nothing else. He was the only one who recorded 20 years after the fact his travels to China and the things that he encountered. So that was that. On the Chinese side, we have this painting that shows one horse. We also have these texts that describe the actual meeting between East and West on that day. Also, the event was recorded in the history of the Yuan Dynasty, which is sort of an official calendar of events. Again, it was compiled way after, but it was compiled. And then there was described the horse being presented by the Europeans, and then the dimensions of the horse. And it also described when the emperor, by the end of the summer, returned to Beijing to start his winter residence in Beijing, that he arrived in early October. Then I bumped into a Chinese source that described how much the emperor adored this gift horse, that he actually rode the horse back to Beijing on that trip, that end of summer trip, a month after the horse was presented. So that brought us to September. The horse was presented in August. So that brought us to September. Then I started looking into the Mongols' dual capital system when it ruled China. Every summer, the emperor and his entourage's court, basically, would move to Inner Mongolia, to what we call Xanadu, to spend the summer. This was actually mentioned by Marco Polo. It was a very well-known system. And then, you know, by the end of summer, they would move back to Beijing. And the travel between the two capitals typically took 3 weeks. So doing a little bit of math, comparing all of these different sources, horse was given on this date. A month later, the emperor, according to a different source, rode the horse back to Beijing. And the Yuan Dynasty history said the emperor arrived in Beijing in early October. I said, bingo, it all works out. It all works out. A month later would be mid-September, and 3 weeks later would be October, would be early October. You know, so I am willing to say I presented the most plausible chronology. I will never dare to say that was the chronology. And so I think, you know, sometimes, of course, we are not lucky. We don't have multiple sources to buttress our ideas or propositions. So from the European side, again, I only have the word of Gian Marinelli and nothing else. So I sort of have to take his words for it, but I have serious doubts. As I said in the articles, he seemed to distinguish the horses that he gave to people as gifts, always to sovereigns, as war horses, these large, powerful, and the most expensive horse on the European market. All the horses he had been given, and he had been given horses by the sovereigns too. Those were just equis, just horse, generic, right? So I sensed from his choice of vocabulary that he was privileging what he brought over what he was given.
I found it fascinating too in the article how you highlight the great importance of this encounter. I believe you said that in the Chinese sources, they don't name John by name or indicate his title in any way. But the story, I found that fascinating, but the story is known. Whereas you compare it to another European traveler in the East, many listeners may be familiar with Marco Polo, and you say by comparison, there's far more mention of this encounter with the gift giving of the horse than there are in these East sources about Marco Polo's travels.
Yes. Except let me tell you something very interesting, something I had not known until I got into this project. Marco Polo became very famous. I mean, his De Vies Monk became very, very famous almost as soon as it was written. Mm-hmm. Multiple hundreds of editions appeared. Marco Polo was unknown, and his travels, the writing, was unknown in China until the 19th century. Wow. Marco Polo was introduced into China by Western missionaries. I had no idea. I grew up knowing about Marco Polo. Modern Chinese historians quote Marco Polo because Marco Polo gave them some information that was not available in Chinese sources. So it's exceedingly interesting to me as Chinese, you know, to sort of see this prehistory of something that I have taken for granted.
It's amazing to think about this discrepancy in the significance given by either side to certain encounters. You know, what are the encounters that we hold on to culturally as people and that we keep in our memory and we keep in our sources? And so that is just so telling. I think that really blew me away, considering how well known Marco Polo is to current scholars and you know, particularly folks in the West. I wondered too if you could say more about the way that this horse gift was perceived on the Mongol side of things. In the epilogue, you write of the, quote, Mongol proclivity for absorbing and using for their own ends the cultural norms and traditions of people who came under Mongol sway. And this idea of absorption really struck me. And I was wondering if you could say more about this recognition that there is power to be gained, I suppose, by absorbing diverse cultures and religions. You write in the piece about the idea that this horse is perceived as a sign of submission, but could you say more about how this is submission by way of absorption, if that makes sense?
Yes and no.
Okay.
So where do I start? I want to start by saying that the Mongols were known to be tolerant and open across the vast empire or empires, because there were four khanates ruled by the Mongols. So in Central Asia, for example, the Uzbek Khan himself had converted to Islam by the early 14th century, but he continued to welcome Franciscan missionaries to preach freely. He even decreed a privilege to the Franciscans to allow them to preach within his dominion. So what I described, the Mongols that I described, the tolerant, open Mongols, applied to those rulers beyond China. So I want to say that. And then also the Mongols were but one ethnic group that had occupied China. Sometimes they occupied the entire China. So the Manchu dynasty, which was the last imperial dynasty of China, there were the Manchus. They were not Han Chinese. But very often China, again, it's a fluctuating boundary, but loosely this landmass that we call China were very often occupied by different ethnic groups, separate into small kingdoms. So it's a landmass that was constantly in flux ethnically and culturally. The Mongols were open to different religions. They just let them do their thing. So another Franciscan missionary, Andrew of Perugia, actually talked about it, saying we're allowed to do whatever openly and freely without restriction. And I think what I used the word absorb was, I think that was a quote, actually. I might have quoted someone while writing that. I think it belongs to a kind of, I'm looking for a word. It's a form of immersion, right? I may be the power coming from beyond the border to you, to rule over you. I think over time, I would pick up things here and there to either complement or to replace or to, for whatever reasons, that I wanted to incorporate into my system, into my beliefs, into my society. It's very telling that the Mongol emperor kept Chinese painters, Chinese poets, Chinese writers in his court. The majority of his court, I'm talking about the artists, were ethnic Chinese. So I think what I'm trying to say is I don't want to over-exaggerate this multicultural thing, because I think that happens quite organically or naturally, probably in many cultures and societies and monarchies, if we look into that. And of course, we're talking about a huge swath of land and, you know, different khanates, and some khanates turned Islamic, some didn't. But in China, under the Mongol rule, yes, religiously, the atmosphere was more open. Mm. But ethnically, there was a system, a four-class system. The uppermost class, the most privileged, were the Mongols, politically. Then came what they called Semuren, or people of all types, meaning not Mongol and not Chinese. And that left the Central Asians, because the Mongols brought in a lot of Central Asians who were East Syriacs, or what used to be called Nestorians, to place them in high places in the government. And the Mongols also intermarried a great deal with these East Syriac Christians from Central Asia. So they were the second, not second class, but on the second level. Mm-hmm. And then the third class, the third level, would be the Chinese from northern China. And the lowest level would be the Chinese in southern China, because that was the area that was the last to be conquered by the Mongols. Now, I mentioned also when the Mongols were experiencing horse shortage, the government started requiring horses to be submitted to the government. Mm. And the first ones to be asked were the southern Chinese and the Koreans. So obviously there were a number of Koreans living in China at the time. So, no, I do not want to give the impression that everything was peaceful, not peaceful, peace is the wrong word, that everything was wonderful. Definitely there was different social classes. There were preferences for one thing over the other.
We're approaching the end of our conversation. So I would just like to ask, is there anything that you would like to share with us that perhaps didn't make it into the final cut of the article that you'd like listeners to know? Anything that you find is really important to this story, but just didn't quite make it into print?
Well, I would like to say something that's not something I would have put into the article, and that is a methodological issue. Mm. Use as much primary material as possible, but be cautious. And I'm saying this specifically to the young up-and-coming scholars as you start. So there's going to be a great deal of secondary sources, no doubt. But remember, second sources tend to interpret the primary sources, if that, right? So get to the primary sources as much as you can. Read the primary sources yourself. Don't rely on other people's quoting, interpreting of the primary sources. Read the primary sources yourself. Primary sources can be text, can be images, can be objects. Make your own interpretation. Find your own clues to the issues that you are interested. So that's how I got to, you know, I think the sources from the setting sun is one of those aha moment. Mm-hmm. And there are other incidents as well. But I cannot emphasize enough the importance of getting to the primary sources. Now, some of the primary sources have been quoted time and time and time again, and you would think that this has been beaten to death. No, go back to it. Read it for yourself. Just read it. And also, sometimes supplementary primary sources, seemingly unrelated to what you're doing, may yield very interesting information as well. And I'm speaking really very much as a historian, wanting to get to the bottom of it, knowing that it's not possible, because primary texts, for example, were written by people and I'm including Marco Polo, I'm including everyone, are written by people with their own perspectives, their own lived experiences, their own prejudices, and their own agenda. I have suggested in the article that John of Marignolli was probably exaggerating his meeting with the Khan by saying there was a procession, there was the blessing, there was the candles and whatnot, to please whoever he perceived to be his reader in Europe, right? So I think we also should consider the person behind the text that you are reading and look into that person as well. So history never ends. I you know, this article, I'm glad that I wrote it, but I know there's a lot more work that can be done if I were to keep digging into it. But I cannot emphasize enough, and I know I'm repeating myself, go to the primary sources, dig deep, and you will find treasures that other people have not found.
Absolutely. I think that's incredible advice to pass along. And I think the same is true as well for literary scholars. I'm having trouble thinking of who said this first, but primary sources, each primary source is a sort of event where it was created by one person at a time, in a place, for an audience, for a purpose. And like you say, you need to go back to the sources and investigate that thoroughly. So apart from enjoying your article in the upcoming issue of Speculum, where else can listeners go to learn more about this East-West encounter and perhaps see these horse paintings or the source material to find more of your work? Where can we point our listeners to learn more?
You know, I have been a museum professional for several decades, so predictably, I will say go to museums. I think that's the best place. Museums are wonderful repositories of objects from different cultures, right? Just go and look. The so-called East-West, this definition, of course, has been expanded in recent decades as the global Middle Ages becomes an emphasis and becomes a subfield in our discipline, which is wonderful. If you go to any museum that has a sizable Chinese collection, for example, you're bound to see pottery horses that probably were imported into China or ridden by foreigners into China. You're bound to see pottery figurines that looked not Chinese, by which I mean wearing hats that are not Chinese, deeper set eyes, beards and the costumes, and playing instruments that obviously were not Chinese. So as I speak, I realize there's also this problem. You have to know what is not Chinese, right? So again, my advice would be so pedantic and so predictable. Just absorb and read and learn as much as you can. But I do believe museums are a wonderful thing. And more museums are putting objects, mixing objects together across cultures and time. Earlier this year, I was in London looking at an exhibition at the British Museum called the Silk Roads, and that's a plural, R-O-A-D-S. And for them, Silk Road extended, multiple routes, extended from Japan all the way to the British Isles. Not to talk about, you know, including Africa and Scandinavia, for example. So I think we have more and more opportunity to see these things. And if you cannot see these things, there are catalogs out there. So this is my suggestion.
I love it. You've heard it here. Everybody should get out there and look at some horses and learn more, probe more. I think some of the best advice I ever received as well was to be a voracious reader and a reader of all things. So thank you so much, Nancy, for sharing all of your wisdom with us and for writing this piece and for continuing this great work. I think I'll conclude here. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This has been an episode of The Multicultural Middle Ages, an Anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America.
Season 4 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Meara, Logan Quigley, and me, Lauren Cantrell, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the notes in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with the latest episodes. Thanks for listening.